Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half-hour autobiography featuring unique personalities whose lives and ideas are on the cutting edge. Alan Wolper is an award-winning journalist and a professor at Rutgers University, Newark. And now, here's Conversations with Alan Wolper.
Ken Thompson made history in 2013 when he became the first African-American to be elected Brooklyn District Attorney. He first won international attention in private practice when he represented a New York hotel maid who alleged she was sexually assaulted by Dominique Strauss-Kahn, then the head of the International Monetary Fund, who was poised to run for president of France. Thompson was an assistant United States attorney who served on the federal prosecution team that brought to justice the police officer who sodomized Abner Louima, one of the most notorious police brutality cases ever tried in New York City. Mr. DA, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Your mother, Clara, was a police officer for 21 years. Your sister, Catherine, was an assistant administrator in the Essex County Prosecutor's Office. It seems that law enforcement runs deeply in your blood.
It does. And it runs deeply in my blood because of my mother, Clara Thompson, who was a pioneer in law enforcement. My mother became a New York City police officer back in 1973 when there were no women police officers on the streets. And she did so while raising three young children alone in New York City public housing.
She had a lot of stories to tell you then.
Yes. Back in 1973, she believed that she could become a New York City police officer. And she was one of the first women to go on patrol in the history of the New York City Police Department back in October of 1973, black or white.
Where was she on patrol?
Well, she worked in a number of precincts in the city. She worked up in the Bronx. She patrolled the streets of Brooklyn at one point. She worked towards the end of her 21 years in Harlem. Her beat was 125th Street. And so my mother was a patrol officer for 21 years, and I remember as a little boy seeing her put on her police uniform in our apartment before she went to work, and then seeing her come back home with the uniform on. As a little boy, I did not understand at the time that the reason why my mother had to do that is because they did not have adequate facilities for women to change into their uniform when they got to the precinct.
So she suffered probably some kind of other kinds of, gender prejudice.
Well, I think that the women who came on the force back in the early 70s were subjected to some hostilities by some of their peers, not all.
Like what? Well, what would happen to her? What'd she tell you about?
She made it clear to me that in the beginning, there were some men who did not want to work with a female partner. They did not believe that they should have to be teamed with a woman as a partner on patrol. And so my mother and the other police women had to endure because they could do the job just as well as anyone else could. And so they had to endure the slights that pioneers have to be willing to suffer in order to open the doors for other people, and that's what she did.
You've made a reputation by forming a special unit that looks back at cases where someone might have been falsely accused, and I suspect that maybe some of the stories your mother told you might have brought to mind when you put that together.
The unit that you were referring to is my conviction review unit, which I started in 2014 in the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office because there were many allegations that men were being wrongfully convicted of murder and other offenses in Brooklyn, and that there were innocent men in prison for murders that they did not commit.
And some of them died in prison, did they not?
Unfortunately, yes. And so I was determined as the new Brooklyn DA to get to the bottom of those cases. And so I started a conviction review unit, and we've looked at more than 50 cases, and we're standing by the majority of the convictions in those cases. But we have concluded that 14 men were wrongfully convicted of murder and other offenses in Brooklyn.
Why? Why would that happen?
There are many reasons for wrongful convictions. The ones that we've been able to uncover in Brooklyn had a lot to do with the fact that many of those cases occurred in the 1980s, 1990s, when New York City was a very different place.
How?
Well, it was primarily different because of the level of crime that was going on. In 1990, there were over 2,000 murders in New York City. Our criminal justice system was overwhelmed with cases. I think that the wrongful convictions occurred because of a systemic failure by prosecutors, by judges, by defense attorneys.
And by a detective by the name of Louis Scarcella.
Louis Scarcella was involved in a number of the cases that have received publicity.
He's retired now.
He is a retired New York City detective. But the issue of wrongful convictions that we have been looking at, the cases that we've been looking at, don't all involve Detective Scarcella. And so if you look at the 14 cases that we have moved on, some of them involve Detective Scarcella, but others do not. And so I think that when people consider wrongful convictions, they don't occur because of one person. They occur because there was a failure by the system. And so what I'm determined to do as the Brooklyn DA is to correct these miscarriages of justice and to work to free men who are in prison unjustly for murders that they did not commit.
You've spoken to them after they've come out, I assume.
I've spoken to some, not all.
And what do they tell you?
One in particular I recall meeting is David McCallum. David McCallum was a 16-year-old boy who was convicted of a murder that occurred in Brooklyn. He was a young man from Bushwick who was accused of going to Queens with another teenager named Willie Stuckey and abducting a man at gunpoint and bringing him to Brooklyn and murdering him. David McCallum maintained from the very beginning that he did not commit that murder, and he was in prison for almost 29 years. And he and his lawyers reached out to me, as did Reuben Hurricane Carter, the boxer, on his deathbed, wrote me a letter and asked me to look at David McCallum's case.
And if anybody knew what a wrongful conviction was, it was Hurricane Carter.
Yes. And so we conducted a thorough investigation of Mr. McCallum's case and concluded that we believed that he was wrongfully convicted, that the only evidence linking him to this murder was a videotape confession that he gave, which we concluded was a false confession. And so there was no fingerprint evidence, no DNA evidence, no eyewitnesses. And so when we moved to vacate his conviction in the interest of justice, he was in a prison way upstate. And so I sent my detectives to go get him, to bring him back to Brooklyn, so we could have a court appearance and free him. And just before the court appearance, he wanted to see me. And so I met him, and it was almost like a scene from a movie. He had his prison outfit on, uniform on. He was shackled, and they were taking the handcuffs off him. And he told me, he said, when you were running for DA, I would listen to the radio for reports every night, and I was praying that you would win. Now, I had no idea that someone who was near the Canadian border in prison was pulling for me to win the Brooklyn DA's race.
He was African-American?
African-American. He and his co-defendant, Willie Stuckey, both of them were convicted of this murder. Both of them were sentenced to 25 years to life. Willie Stuckey, unfortunately, died at the age of 31 from a massive heart attack while maintaining his innocence in prison. So we were not able to get Willie Stuckey out. But one of the things I was able to do is I was able to track down Willie Stuckey's mother. And I asked her if she would come to court and stand in his shoes. Because when I called her that night, I told her, I said I was a new Brooklyn district attorney and that we had investigated her son's case and concluded that he was wrongfully convicted. And all I could hear on the other side of the phone was her crying uncontrollably. She said she knew all these years that her son did not commit that murder. And so the wrongful conviction cases are important because wrongful convictions destroy families. They destroy lives.
You said you ran for district attorney because you felt that the prior district attorney, Charles Joe Hines, had lost his way.
The Brooklyn District Attorney's Office is the third largest DA's office in the country, behind Los Angeles and the city of Chicago. There are nearly 1,200 employees and 530 prosecutors. We do 100,000 cases a year. An office of that size, with that magnitude, is extremely important, not only for the city, but for the country. And it clearly lost its way years ago, because there's no way that so many men should have been wrongfully convicted for murders that they did not commit. And so I was determined to do my part to fix the Brooklyn DA's office, to bring a different culture to that office, a culture of fairness, because I believe in my heart that the main duty of a district attorney or any prosecutor is to do justice, not just to convict.
You're listening to Conversations with Alan Wolper on WBGO 88.3 and WBGO.org. Our guest is Brooklyn District Attorney Ken Thompson. Mr. DA, we've talked about your law enforcement life. Let's discuss a little bit about your personal life. And giving us an example of why you could have been a police officer. At one point you decided you might do that, then you wound up in John Jay. What made you change your mind?
Well, when I saw my mother every day with her police uniform, it sort of left an indelible impression upon me. And it was almost inevitable that I would go into law enforcement. And so I decided to take the New York City Police Department exam to follow my mother's footsteps. And I did very well on the exam. I was 18 years old. I think I scored a 97 on the exam.
Oh, you missed out on three questions
well,
or something?
Well, no.
I would try to keep this down. I didn't realize you were having that kind of a problem.
I should be ashamed. But I spoke to my mother, and she told me that she wanted me to pursue something else.
So they taught you well at Norman Thomas High School?
They did. They did. But I decided to go to law school. And so I was on the road to becoming a police officer, but decided to pursue a career in law. And I think that I am grateful that I'm able to serve as Brooklyn DA, because I think that I have a background that I think is important for someone like me to serve in a position as one of the five DAs in the city. Someone who started out life in the New York City public housing.
You were at the Wagner houses, and then you moved to the Bronx.
Yes.
Co-op City.
I was born in Harlem Hospital, and I started out life in the Wagner houses in East Harlem. And then my mother became a police officer and moved us up to Co-op City, where I spent my formative years. I went to New York City public schools. I went to Norman Thomas High School. And then I went to John Jay College.
And people said you were a bookworm.
Well, I love
you don't look like a bookworm.
No, but I love reading books because I had a long commute from Co-op City to my high school. My high school was on 33rd Street and Park Avenue. And this is before all of these, you know, iPhones and all of these gadgets. And so I had a two-fare zone, and I just read.
You knew how to spell subway. Yeah.
I did. And I read. And I think that my love of reading helped lay the foundation for me to become a lawyer later in life. And so I graduated John Jay College with honors.
Magna cum laude.
Yes, and I was fortunate to get accepted into NYU Law School. And at that point, I met people from all over the country, because NYU is a fabulous law school. It's one of the best in the country.
I went to NYU, and people there said it was really hard to get into their own school. So I'll just tell you that.
It was a great experience in my life, because I met a professor there named Ron Noble, Professor Noble, who had been a federal prosecutor in Philadelphia and in Maine Justice in Washington, D.C. And I took his course. I took a number of classes with him. And when I graduated, he became the Undersecretary for Enforcement in the U.S. Treasury Department. President Clinton appointed him to a big position there where he was over the Secret Service, the Customs Service, ATF, and he hired me as his special assistant. And then there was this big raid down in Waco, Texas, with David Koresh and the Branch Davidians, where four federal agents were killed and 20 others were shot when they were trying to execute search warrants at the Branch Davidian compound. Then there was a siege for months, and then there was this terrible fire where over 80 people died, including scores of children. And so Professor Noble, who at that point was in charge of the Secret Service and the ATF, was ordered by President Clinton to conduct an investigation into that matter, and I was one of his special assistants, and he allowed me to write part of the Waco report that went to President Clinton, and that put me on the path of becoming a federal prosecutor, because when I was in D.C., Eric Holder, who was the U.S. Attorney of Washington, D.C. at the time, offered me a position to work with him. And I got an offer to come back home to Brooklyn and work for Zach Carter, who was a U.S. attorney in Brooklyn at the time, and I wanted to come back home.
Ironically, one of the biggest controversies in media was the fact, the way the media behaved way back then in Waco, Texas, reporting before the prosecutors want them to do anything about it. And I was thinking about that when I was reading some of the work that your special team is doing about finding people who were wrongfully committed. And yet you gave credit to the New York Times in 2013 for their investigation.
It's the truth. I mean, what helped bring light to this issue of wrongful convictions was, I think, a series of articles that the New York Times ran back in 2013. And many of those articles focused on retired detective Louis Scarsella. And it really caused people to wonder what was going on in Brooklyn. And so I think the New York Times should be credited for outstanding journalism on this issue. But I also think that many people have come together in Brooklyn to get to the bottom of these cases. I am determined to get to the truth. And one of the fortunate things I was able to do is I was able to get a law professor at Harvard Law School named Ron Sullivan, who's in charge of Harvard's criminal clinic, to serve as my special counsel for wrongful convictions. And so Professor Sullivan has been coming down from Cambridge to Brooklyn to help me build this unit. Out of the 500-plus prosecutors I inherited when I became DA, only two of them were assigned to look at these cases, and there were about 100 cases. And they weren't even sitting next to each other on the same floor, and they weren't given any resources. So Professor Sullivan helped me build a conviction review unit, which I think is the largest in the country. It costs $1.1 million annually to run. And it is, I think, considered a model conviction review unit in the nation.
Well, you were involved in getting back to your federal life as an assistant U.S. attorney. You were involved in part of that very, very well-thought-of investigative unit that wound up prosecuting Justin Volpe because of a fellow named Abner Louima who was brutalized in a precinct, in a New York police precinct. Ironically, his father, Robert Volpe, was one of the most decorated New York City police officers. I assume that that had something to do with you wanting to be a district attorney?
Well, that case was extremely important because in the Abner Louima case, you had a badly beaten, defenseless man who was handcuffed behind his back, taken into a New York City police precinct, the 70th precinct, and by a New York City police officer, and sodomized with a broken broomstick. And so the community was outraged, and Abner Louima was badly injured, and I was very fortunate to be part of the federal team, which included Loretta Lynch.
Who's now the Attorney General of the United States.
Yes. Loretta Lynch and I and Alan Vingrad, who's an outstanding prosecutor, we made up the federal prosecution team. And I was a young federal prosecutor who was put on the team with Loretta and Alan. And what they gave me an opportunity of a lifetime because they asked me to do the opening statement on behalf of the United States.
Didn't you get an original tip on that?
I did. One of my classmates from NYU Law School called me and told me that he was representing someone who was sodomized by police officers in a bathroom, and I thought that he was joking. So that's how the case came to the office. I was eventually put on the case, but to be given the honor of delivering the opening statement was something I did not expect, but I was very prepared for it. And when I delivered that opening statement, my mother was in that courtroom. She had retired from the police department, but she was able to see her son, her youngest son, stand up and deliver that opening statement on behalf of the United States.
It must have been pretty compelling because he pleaded guilty, didn't he, halfway during the trial?
We broke him in the middle of the trial, and he was sentenced to, we broke Justin Volpe, who was then sentenced to 30 years in prison, and he's still in prison to this day. And so that particular case was very important because we were able to get justice for Abner Louima in that federal civil rights trial. And I was able to work closely with Loretta Lynch and see her integrity and see her enormous ability. And that's why when the president nominated her to become attorney general, I was delighted.
You're listening to Conversations with Alan Wolper on WBGO 88.3 and WBGO.org as we've been listening to the professional and personal life story of Brooklyn District Attorney Ken Thompson. But the world found out about you in a very, very big way. You're smiling. You know where I'm going, right? When a young woman, not so young, came to you and said she'd like you to represent her because she claimed that she was sexually assaulted by a man who was then the head of the International Monetary Fund and claimed that she was raped. And he said, no, it was consensual. And you said,
I said that I was going to stand up for the woman you're referring to, Nafissatou Diallo, who had come to this country from West Africa as an immigrant, who had come to this country because of the great promise of America, and who got a job cleaning hotel rooms at the Sofitel in Midtown Manhattan. And she came to me and told me that she was sexually assaulted by Dominique Strauss-Kahn. And she needed a lawyer to help her.
You know who that was at the time?
I knew about it because it was all in the papers at the time.
I'm talking about him.
No. I knew what the International Monetary Fund was, but I didn't follow Dominique Strauss-Kahn, his career, but quickly learned a lot about him and learned that he was expected to run for the presidency of France. But my main concern was to get justice for Ms. Diallo.
Do you think she got justice? The district attorney in New York, in Manhattan, Cyrus Vance, felt that there was not enough evidence to convict him or take him to trial, really. And you said that he didn't have the courage to go forward.
Well, I think that my role at the time was a zealous advocate for my client. I think that Ms. Diallo did get a measure of justice because after the criminal case was dismissed, I filed a civil suit up in the Bronx State Supreme, where she lived. She lived in the Bronx, against Dominique Strauss-Kahn, and that case was settled. And so I think that Ms. Diallo...
How much money did she get?
That's not something that is... That's not something that I'm interested in discussing. I think it's important to just know that Ms. Diallo is doing very well, and that the justice system did come through for her.
Let's talk about something else that you're doing right now, something called the Special Project on Warrants.
Yes.
Everybody, I think, is concerned. I know that a lot of people in New York, for example, in New York City, don't make their court appearances for a variety of reasons. And I assume that this is part of what you're after. Why this happened?
Well, it's
why does it happen?
Well, it's a certain type of warrant. I don't want your listeners to think that we are working to vacate warrants of people who committed armed robberies or bank robberies. This is a problem that we have in New York City. We have over 1.2 million open warrants for minor offenses.
What is a warrant?
Well, a warrant is an order from a judge that seeks the arrest of someone. And what we have here is, in New York City, if you commit a minor offense such as riding your bike on a sidewalk or walking your dog without a leash, you can be given a summons, a ticket by a police officer.
I'd say I feel like doing that myself half the time these days.
If you don't go to court when you're supposed to, a bench warrant is issued for your arrest for any reason. So
for traffic ticket?
It's not a traffic ticket. This is a different type of ticket. This is a low-level offense. If you don't go to court, they issue a bench warrant for you. The problem with that is if you can't get off from work or you'll lose your job, if you can't go to court because you have a sick child at home or something else is preventing you from coming, a bench warrant is issued. So now the next time the police see you or stop you and run your name, that warrant is going to pop up and they're going to place you in handcuffs and bring you to central booking. I think that we have to have a better system here in New York City. I think a bench warrant should be issued for those who refuse to come to court, not those who cannot come to court. And so I have a new program called Begin Again, where I bring the court system into the community on Saturdays. And I bring judges, I bring legal aid attorneys, and my own prosecutors. And we hold court typically in a church. We're going to do one in a synagogue next year as well. And we let people who have these warrants come. We vacate these warrants so they can begin again and move on with their lives. This is important not only for the person who has the warrant, but for our police officers, because we don't want them to be placed in unnecessary danger when they approach someone who has a warrant.
One last question, I think, and that is you're in a position, a district attorney, where you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. And because you are the first black district attorney, I kind of suspect you're getting a lot of pressure from a lot of places. What's that like in about a minute and a half?
I would tell you that it's important for me to do what I believe is the right thing to do with all my cases, regardless of the pressure that may be put on me from different parts of the community or for different groups, because a DA has to stand strong and protect public safety, but also to make sure that we improve our system of justice for all. And so it doesn't matter the pressure they put on me. It really matters what my mother put in me as a little boy, and that is principles of fairness and principles of equal justice, regardless of how much money you have or where you come from or where you live. There's got to be one standard of justice for all, and I believe that.
Ken Thompson, Brooklyn District Attorney, thank you for sharing some of the most memorable cases in recent New York history with us.
Thank you.
Joanna Walper is a senior producer of our program, and Doug Doyle is our executive producer. Conrad Sanguinetti is our engineer. If you'd like to listen to any of our other autobiographies, just Google Conversations with Alan Walper. Until we talk again, I'm Alan Walper.
Special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District. And support for Conversations with Alan Walper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.